Welcome to the Drunk Guys Book Club, where books aren't just for school, where book clubs aren't just for women, and we're masters of the Bruniverse.
I'm Mike.
I'm Nate.
I'm Jimmy.
And we're the Drunk Guys, and this week we're reading The Bonfire of the Vanities by Tom Wolfe, and I'm starting with a beer. So the first, and I guess really the main character of the book is Tom Hanks, Mean Tom Hanks, Sherman McCoy. And he's the master of the universe, we'll see. But it's like, he's got his whole, his like career stuff all worked out and his family stuff. And he's kind of, everything's kind of like compartmentalized, at least in the beginning. And that's the name of this beer, which is a double IPA from Finback that is made with all the hops. It's 8.4%. That's very nice. That's tastes like living in a really expensive penthouse, must feel. So, Bonfire of the Vanities came out in 1987.
So did we.
We did. Nate came out of his first retirement, and we came out of a womb. it's really a novel about what New York was like in the mid-80s, and it was exactly what you think. Join us next week.
Yeah.
But it starts with Sherman McCoy, who is a bond trader.
And which is just as thrilling as it sounds.
I mean, he's a rich finance bro before they were called finance bros. And he lives in his, in 1987, $3 million apartment. So that's a fucking ridiculous. And works for some firm. And I pictured a lot of stuff from other movies like Wall Street. And
it's had to be like
American
like
Psycho.
This was American Psycho, just short of the murder. And what was that?
In American Psycho, did they ever say what the job was, or did he just have some nothing job? Like, was it never really mentioned? I don't remember.
No, in American Psycho, he just worked on Wall Street.
He was in finance. He was into murders and executions.
Murders and executions. Right. Mm-hmm, that's right.
So Sherman McCoy.
That line is better than this book.
Oh, yeah. Well, Sherman McCoy is a master of the universe, and apparently this book, like, coined that phrase, because they say it about 1,000 times.
I thought that was the fucking He-Man cartoon.
I think in the context of, like, you know, self-important career
stock
people,
bros,
douchebags, who expect the world to work how they want it to always. I don't think that's what He-Man was about. I think He-Man was about closeted homosexuality and a skeleton.
You just wanted to bone.
That's true. Skeletor, I've got a bone to suck with you. It's like, that's not how that works, He-Man. So he starts off and he's, you know, in 1987 rich guy terms, he has got it made. He's like the top salesman at his firm, and he's got a hot wife who does whatever the 1980s version.
A wife who used to be hotter.
Well, yeah, because she's a little old. She's getting a little old in the tooth. But he's got a side piece who's also very hot. And he's got a kid that he really likes, and she goes to the right school, and their apartment's been in, like, Architectural Digest or whatever. And it's just awesome. And then things start to kind of fall apart for him, and will spiral for the remainder of the book. And becomes a masturbator of the universe.
So, opening scene of the book, he's going to take his dog out for a walk in the evening. Now, his wife is immediately suspicious because this isn't something he usually does, and it's raining. And she's like, "Where are you going?" He's like, "Nowhere. I'm just taking the dog for a walk." And so he goes outside in the rain, finds a phone booth, because they didn't all have cell phones yet, finds a phone booth and tries to call his mistress, but he accidentally dials his own home phone number and asks for, what's her name?
Maria,
yes. He asks, and his wife is like, "Sherman, is that you?" And he's immediately like, "Oh, no. I've already fucked this up badly." And he's like, "What am I going to do? Oh, no." And he says immediately, like, "Ugh." He's like, "Oh, no, I'm sorry, wrong number," and hangs up.
Okay.
And he's like,
"Como?
Pourquoi?"
Yeah, he wouldn't deign to speak Spanish.
But he thinks in his mind immediately, like, "I'm terrible at lying. I'm going to go back when I get back home. I'm going to my wife is immediately going to go, was that you? And I'm going to have to lie, but she's going to see right through it. So fuck it. Why not just go see my, why don't I just go see Maria instead? So his mistress, who is also rich, is renting a rent-stabilized apartment a couple of blocks from his epic mansion apartment. And then he goes over there and says, you won't believe what just happened, and then fucks her anyway.
Well, important plot point, for some reason, in the final pages of the book, is she is subletting a rent-stabilized apartment from a friend. Because the entire plot, for some reason, hinges on that.
Yes, that's actually a really important, going to be an important point later. So this book was originally published in serial form, like Charles Dickens, but in Rolling Stone magazine.
It must have taken them 8 years. It's a monthly apparently magazine.
And not only that, but Tom Wolfe was a famous writer before this, but this was his first novel. He was famous for his journalism.
And for wearing those fucking foppish white suits always.
That's his, like, was he the suit guy?
He's the white
the
suit.
Big hat?
Yeah. Yeah, he looked like a little jockey.
He was kind of one of those, like, fucking postmodern, weird shit, like, trout fishing kind of guys.
Well, because he wrote, he wrote the right
Kool-Aid
stuff.
Acid Test thing?
Which is great, a little boring. But yeah, he wrote the Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test. And there's another similarly stupid titled one, like the Candy Colored Flavor Bus or something like that. I'm trying to find the title of it. I was hoping I'd find it faster.
I hope it's that. It's not that.
The Candy Colored Tangerine Flake Streamline Baby. I was not that far off for what that says.
Streamline Baby?
I know, it's his first nonfiction book. And then he also wrote, The Right Stuff. And a bunch of things that I don't know, I don't recognize these names. And then he wrote other novels afterwards, but this was his first one. So he was known as like a journalist, but like also hip, you know, so like peak Rolling Stone kind of writer.
Okay. I don't know if that genre of person exists these days. Like, I can't think of a hip journalist.
David Sedaris, but he's more like a memoirist. I mean, I think there are writers that just write, you know, if you keep up with the zine scene, if you're reading The New Yorker, you probably know some of these names, which I do not read that. Every once in a while, I get an issue of The New Yorker, I'm like, this is like a fucking book, and then I give up on it instantly. So, serialized, but also apparently it was heavily edited and modified from the serial form and expanded.
Was it too long?
It was too short. Much too short. Not enough bonfire.
So Sherman goes back home, and his wife is like stayed up just to like wait for him to get back home, and she's immediately like, I know it was you. And he's like, no, of course not.
No, it was me, what? Right? He doesn't even lie well.
No, he does a really bad job, and he's going to do that multiple other times in the book too. And his wife is immediately furious at him, even though but he still continues to deny it. Then there's a bunch more stuff about bond trading. And then here's the important part of the book. So a couple days later, Maria is coming back from Italy. And he and Sherman goes to like pick her up at the airport. So Sherman tells his wife, hey, yeah, I've got to work. I got to work late tonight. But instead drives his incredibly expensive Mercedes to the airport, picks her up and all her luggage, and then goes to drive her back to her apartment, to her subletted rent stabilized apartment, not to her incredibly rich husband, so that they can bone. But they take a wrong turn along the way, and they end up in the Bronx, and they're afraid.
I've done it. You miss the exit, I mean, then you're on the fucking bridge. It's like, well, I guess I'll just turn around.
If you've driven at all in New York, like, this is a thing that happens. You're like, oh, whoops, that's where I needed to go. Oops. And so you just got to go off, turn around. But this is the Bronx of 80s New York, when, at least as I'm told, it was a very rough neighborhood.
Dude, the book...
And it still is.
It was... There, you can go find a footage of Reagan campaigning in the Bronx. I think it's an 80, but it might have been 84. When he's standing on one of those street, the many streets in the South Bronx where they're just burnt out, empty apartment buildings. And he goes, "I haven't seen anything this bad since Berlin, since the Blitz," is what he says. And no one was like, "Come on now, Ronnie." They were like, "Yeah, that's pretty accurate." It was really bad. There were entire stretches of blocks of just abandoned, burned out buildings. It was better to get the insurance money than to like make the modest repairs of buildings and rent them to poor people. And crime was rampant. I mean, all of New York was very criminally ridden in the 80s.
Yeah, but crime was very bad in all of America, and like really all of America, but especially in big cities and especially in New York. I mean, New York was still recovering from its like big financial catastrophe in the 70s, where a lot of services were cut. And
the documentary The Warriors was filmed.
It's true. It is the first reality television programming, I think. Nate has no. Nate, did you see The Warriors?
No.
Do you know what we're talking about though?
I don't.
Oh, it's a classic.
It's a cult movie of New York street gangs from like 1979, and they're just comically stupid gangs. Like the one gang where they all dress up as baseball players, but have face paint on them, and they don't talk.
Or, and there's a girl gang called the Lizzies.
And they all meet. They meet in the Bronx,
they
right?
They meet in Yankee Stadium because there's so many gangs in New York. They fill Yankee Stadium, and they're going to take over the city. But then someone shoots the guy who's going to lead them all, and they blame the Warriors. And they say, "We've got to take the train back to Coney Island to be safe.
Get on our
and that's
turf.
The whole movie.
But there's enough gangs that they have like a conference, like they're at a room at the Ramada.
It's the fucking UN. It's
and
not a good.
They're
movie.
Like, "We can dig it." Okay, anyway. So he gets turned around.
New York
and
was
up
very,
in,
very rough.
And he's in the Bronx, and he's like, "Oh my God, I'm going to die today."
Yes.
And it was possible. It's like, oh, this chance of death went up 11,000% because he's driving a really flashy car, and. You know,
and there's no GPS. He's just looking for a road to take him back to a bridge at night in the Bronx, which I wouldn't know how to fucking do without a map.
No. I remember not that long, like in the early 2000s even, my parents were like pulling over and asking, where the fuck are we? Like, just how do we get to the highway from here? Like, not in New York so much, but on road trips and stuff. That was a... People got lost a lot more often, I guess. We have forgotten about that. That's been memory hold.
I moved to New York right in 2008, which is also right when the iPhone came out, which has Google Maps and GPS. I don't think I would have survived without it. Just not only getting around, but just the number of times I've had the, you know, experience of, okay, I'm here, but where the fuck is it?
Right. I never had to print out MapQuest things and put them in your pocket and go wherever you were going.
Dude, I remember doing that.
Oh yeah,
I remember the like being a college student with no printer paper and like, oh, I'm gonna write down the MapQuest directions.
Oh yeah. But that didn't save Sherman because no. This was the 80s, and he, instead of getting back on the highway, he hits a kid with a car.
Well, he doesn't hit the kid. They pull.
Yeah, so.
He almost does.
They think they find a ramp, and they're like find a road to a ramp, and they like try and go over. But there's like the tire blocking the road, and there are two youths of color who are standing there. And Sherman is really afraid of them, but he has to like stop and get out. I can't exactly remember why.
He has to move the stuff out of the way of the road so he can drive.
So he gets out, but then like the one big guy is like, "Hey, you need some help with that." And Sherman immediately thinks he's about to die. So instead, he throws the tire at him, and then Maria goes over to the driver's side and starts and like, you know, is going to drive. And so he jumps in the car. But Maria, like either going, I can't remember if she backed up or forward.
She sideswipes somebody.
She's like a fishtail kind of thing. She's like.
She hits the other kid, the skinny kid.
Maybe. And sort of. Possibly.
We get it from their perspective, so
at first
they're
he's
not
like,
sure.
He's like, I heard a thump.
I heard a kid sounding thump. But it could have been anything.
I heard a thump, and then the kid wasn't there anymore. I don't know. Could that be it? But at first, he's like, everybody's, you know, in kind of, they're kind of in denial. But anyway, this part where Maria is driving and hits somebody, and then they drive away. Isn't that exactly what happens in Great Gatsby?
So I guess what you're saying, Nate, is ladies and driving.
Anyway, because...
He didn't deny it.
He's from a different time, Mike.
It was 1987. It was a long time ago.
But no, because Nate. Maria has now hit somebody, and, I mean... He's not dead yet, but is going to die. That makes her a murderess or a murderess.
Oh.
This is a barrel, barley wine style ale laid to rest in bourbon barrels for 4 years.
Wow.
And this is by Pipeworks.
Dude, how did you not use that for him banging the mistress that he's putting in some pipe work?
That works too.
Yeah, and his wife would have felt pretty murderous if she found out.
Oh my god. This is this really tastes like raisins and bourbon. That's what it tastes like.
A winning combination.
Yep. And alcohol. It's quite strong. But it's good.
I feel like you're describing a cologne right now.
Raisins and bourbon.
No, it's a raisin. And sandalwood.
For some reason, what it tastes like to me is raisins.
It's a barley wine, right?
More like,
that makes sense.
More like rum raisin ice cream, actually.
Oh, the oldest person of ice cream flavors?
Minus the ice cream part. I mean, if you like rum raisin, then you'll probably like this. It'll get you really drunk. Because it is 14.3% alcohol. But yeah.
That'd be an expensive can.
It was. I think it was like $12. Nope, $12.99 right there. Wow. Yep.
That's not terrible, actually, for a four-year aged beer.
No.
And for a big one of it, it's like drinking a bottle of fucking wine.
And this is And this is the first Pipeworks beer I think we've had in quite a while.
It's been a while, yeah. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen them in a minute.
So that's the first thread of the story, and we're going to start adding other characters. The next one is the... Is it next introduces the journalist guy or it introduces the lawyer?
Next is Kramer, the DA.
Right. So Kramer is, he's not.
Our Jewishest character.
He is remarkably Jewish. It is said many times.
He lives with his wife and their kid in a shitty place because he's just a poor ADA up in. He works in the Bronx, but he lives in Manhattan somewhere, but in like a real small shithole, even though he has a live-in nanny for a month or something. But they're, you know, it's a different time. I don't know. And he's trying a big case against a Nation of Islam guy.
Henry 92X or something, right?
Yeah.
Is Herman. He a radio station?
Yeah. And this is a part of the book that is also the rest of the book where everyone is described solely by their race and how those people are. Yeah. And they all talk like real, like, you know, New Yorky New Yorkers. You know, like they talk like that, which people certainly do. But everyone in this book does if they are not Sherman.
Well, Sherman's like so waspy, so he's got to be, you know.
This beer is for them. It's called Gimme the Gorbage. And it's, what the fuck is this? This is a milk stout. And it's, I don't know, like 6% something. This is from a Little House Brewing. That's where Sherman lives too.
That's true, yeah.
Kramer lives in a little house. It's relatively tame for what stouts have become. It's definitely a little malty. It doesn't punch you in the face, which, you know, is all right. And he has a picture of a raccoon playing a banjo and eating out of the trash. Okay, yeah. Give me the gorbage. I thought that was fitting enough.
It's pretty good.
Not as dumb as my other one, so.
Oh, there's another one coming? All right, great.
Oh, yeah.
So Larry Kramer is, looking to make a big case, and he's trying one against a guy who, like, spends his entire case. I mean, it's just, like, a non-important detail of the story, the Henry Nation of Islam, or whatever the fuck is, Harold 92.
Well, it introduces him to another side important character to Kramer, which is a hot lady on the jury.
The lady with the brown lipstick?
Yes, she has brown lipstick.
I was trying to think.
Much like this milk stout. Wow, it works over and over again.
I was trying to think the whole time, like, how was that hot looking? But it was a different time.
He liked them duty lips.
Your Honor, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I am guilty of one thing, and it's liking them duty lips. Okay.
So, he likes an ass kisser.
So he's, because every man in this book wants to fuck someone besides his wife, so he is interested in banging her. And I think he wins the case because it's like the most obvious case ever.
And the guy shot a guy in a bar, but he shot the wrong guy.
Yeah. And he spends his entire defense is basically just saying, that's not my name, it's Henry 92. whatever, dude, shut the fuck up. So,
there's numerous rants on the narrator part and on, I guess, from, they kind of change perspectives for each chapter. So it's like a narrator from that person's perspective or like their inner monologue. And a lot of Kramer's things are about the quote unquote justice system in America, or at least in the Bronx, where it's just all he does spend all day is locking up poor people for crimes that, they certainly committed, but that it's just a meat grinder of human suffering that does nothing for anyone except put kids in jail forever. And it's dumb.
So you're saying there's a system, an industrial system in America that is grinding Americans and people into an unending chain of suffering that can only be ended with revolutionary violence via the mail. I think we have another book about that coming out soon.
Oh, God, we do. Yeah. But, yeah, so that's his chapter. And eventually, of course, since he's the other character, he will get saddled with the case of the kid that got hit by a car and then ran away. But it takes a while to get there. It takes too long to get there, which is a recurring theme of this book.
And justice.
And justice. The wheels of justice are slow, as are the wheels of this book.
So then the third character is the reporter guy, who's a drunk, and he is...
He's British, and I forget his name.
It's Peter?
Peter.
Peter
Fallow.
Yeah, sure, why not?
And he's a drunk, because and Peter he just Rabbit. Goes around town getting people to buy him drinks because he doesn't have any money because he spent it on drinks.
And he's a shitty reporter. I think in the 80s there were still 18,000 newspapers. I think that was starting to really end, but in the 80s and 90s is when a lot of the smaller newspapers were getting absorbed into bigger ones or just closing down. So he's a tabloid reporter, which means something different 40 years ago than it means today. Because now, when
it literally meant the shape of the newspaper.
Exactly. But they, because something about the shape of them meant that those were shittier. I don't really know why or how.
Yeah, they folded sideways and they were a different square.
Yeah, because the gentleman's newspaper is the one you have to fold 19 times. You ever watch old people read the New York Times? How they pull out sections and they fold it like it's a fucking veteran's flag at a funeral.
It's like a fortune teller.
And then they end up reading one column. It's like, how did you do that? Like an origami thing. You know what I'm talking about, Nate?
It's a lost art. Yes. I have struggled over newspapers myself. Thank God for the internet.
Back when you were a newsie.
Well, it was a big improvement over the cuneiform of his youth.
How do you fold those tablets?
I keep breaking them.
My God, I almost get to the end of the Gilgamesh story. Okay, so then
the newspaper reporter is
he needs to have a he needs a big important story. He needs a case because
he needs
he's going to get fired. He sucks at he's doing a shitty job lately.
And then halfway through the book, halfway through the book, somebody comes to him and says, "Hey, I've got the story. This woman who, lives in the Bronx, her son got hit by a car, and now he's in a coma, and the police aren't doing anything about it."
Was it Reverend Bacon, the schemer?
The Al Sharpton, Reverend Jesse Jackson character of the book?
Yeah, who is... that guy, Reverend Bacon, is very cynically like using this going to use this event to like raise his own profile.
Did you say racist own profile, Nate?
Wow, Freudian.
You would.
And so the reporter gets the tip, but it's not until like halfway through the book, and then starts looking into it, and then it turns into a big story because New Yorkers. It's sort of pitting the parts of New York against each other, or more like the black community versus the Wall Street guys versus the, you know.
But he also does some, it is granted, objectively, not a good thing to hit and run a kid with your car. It's a real dick move. But he plays it up because he's a shitty journalist. He's like, he calls the kid's teacher. He's like, would you say that he was a good student? He's like, he was, better than the other kids who are all terrible. And he's like an honor student. Like, well, we don't have an honors program because these kids can't read. But I guess you could say that he would be an honor student if that was a thing. Maybe. I don't know. He might've been going to college. Maybe. I don't know how he would have done there in a real school. And so in the paper's version, it's, basically this, honor student struck down in his prime before he could make it out of the projects to the, but what they called in the old days, yellow journalism, which is, embellished or outright fake. And, another thing that's, this works on multiple levels. Once again, another thing that's yellow is cake. And what he's doing is fake news. So this is cake news.
I don't know. If it was and it's in a yellow can.
I don't know if all of that was necessary. Could have just said it's cake news.
No, I know. But then the yellow thing really worked out well for it's bullshit. This is a strawberry imperial stout. And it's like, I don't know, 10.5%. Who the fuck makes this? Omnipollo. Another one we haven't seen in a long time.
I honestly don't know, dear listeners, if Jimmy spends a lot of time in the beer store or if he grabs at random and makes it up later.
I would say 10 minutes looking through all of them and thinking, I could make that work. And sometimes I think, I saw this one like right away. I was like, I could work with that. That is a lot of strawberry. Fuck me. Good Lord. It's pretty good, but it is, I'm going to say that's almost too much strawberry.
It's,
and it tastes like 10.5% alcohol. Good Lord. That one will fuck you up.
That sounds good.
Oh, good Lord. Yeah. It's real sticky.
Oh, I take it back.
Much like the situation that Sherman has found himself in.
So okay, just talk about, I really enjoyed the scene where they introduce Reverend Bacon, or when Tom introduces Reverend Bacon. And it's when some kind of like lower level lawyers have to go ask him about the money their company is like gave him for some project.
He's been given a bunch of money to build some sort of community center or something like that.
Yeah, it was a daycare.
It's a daycare, and they gave $350,000, which it's like $1 million. That's like a huge amount of money, and they find out like he tried to put on the board all ex-cons, which the law specifically prohibits. And so they're like, all right, so we can't do that. So we need to like put the money in an escrow account or something until we figure it out. He's like, no. They're like, well, where is the money? And he's like, oh, it's invested. I'm like, what the fuck does that mean? Like, you did nothing. Nothing. There's nothing to show. And it's clear he's a complete grifter, just hustling people and then turning on the like preacher talk or the like race talk to get his for his own gain, like, or he claims it's for the community, but he's completely full of shit. So Tom Wolfe, I think Tom Wolfe said he's a composite of Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson. I think Tom Wolfe himself said that, or I certainly read that somewhere about that. There's a part where Kramer has to talk to, because the woman who's like, my son got hit by a car and he's in a coma, she gives this information to Reverend Bacon, and Reverend Bacon's like, I will trade on this to get, for whatever he can gain from it, apparently. And so Kramer has to go there with the two detectives, and they are the Irish detective and the Irish Jewish detective. Like, he can't decide if he's Irish or Jewish.
He's Jewish, but since he's a cop, he acts Irish.
Right. and they hate him. And it's actually really funny when they have to stand to shake his hand, how they're really disappointed in themselves that they had to stand. And so when the woman comes in, they don't want to have to stand again, so they are already standing. So it seems like, oh, they're just coming over. Like, they're just total clowns. But then she comes in. She has a very, very vague story of what happened to her son. She's like, well, my son...
My son, who's in a coma,
yeah,
told me that he went to the hospital for his broken hand, but didn't say he was hit by a car. But when he came home, he got worse and then told me he got hit by a car. And he got the first letter of the license plate and three choices for the second letter of the license plate. And wouldn't even say where it happened, didn't say exactly what time, just said, yeah, got hit. It was a Mercedes. Did he even say it was Mercedes? Yeah.
I think they just said it was an expensive luxury car.
Expensive car. Because something like that.
He had the kind of car and two letters in the license plate, which is how they narrowed it down.
And so the detective says, okay, lady, so this is almost nothing. Like, there's no way that this is going to ever lead to anything, because we don't know where it happened. When did it happen? And the only evidence we have is from somebody who is now in a coma and can't speak for themselves. And they only got one letter of the license plate. We've got nothing here. And Rufford Bacon is like, oh, now this is going to be the thing. I'm going to turn this into this whole big news story about how the police just don't want to investigate. They don't think it's worth it because the kid is black. And that, yeah, becomes a thing. And if this was real life, that's kind of exactly what would happen. Or what would happen is the police would go, we have almost nothing to go on. You know, there's like, how would we possibly even narrow it down to like one to anybody?
And in a courtroom, none of this will hold up in any meaning.
Yeah. Because even if they happen to find somebody who they think might have done it, it would be like, can you even place me at the scene? No.
There's no actual evidence that he's been hit by a car in the first place.
And that's what the cops, their immediate theory is. He just got beat up. He got into some sort of trouble, and he doesn't want to say what happened to him, really. So he made up this story to tell his mom.
And now he's unconscious, so they can't question him at all.
But the Reverend Bacon is like, this is an outrage. You must do this. You must remedy this, And Kramer is like, oh, yikes. But,
And the mayor and the district attorney, they're like, they don't want to look bad.
Oh, actually, was it the first scene? Was the first scene when the mayor gets like, heckled?
That's the prologue.
That was, the very first scene is the mayor. I guess he's supposed to be, it's not Koch, because they say Koch's name at some point, I feel like.
But as a character, the mayor was clearly Abe Beam, who was Jewish and very short.
But the mayor gets heckled and abused by a crowd of black people in the beginning because he's out of touch with, So the mayor is looking for a way to remedy his image.
It's a perfect storm of political controversy. So this case becomes, the cause du jour for everybody on all sides of everything.
So the police, they are goaded into actually putting in some work. So they look up all the license plates, all the registered license plates, and they try and figure out, well, it's probably, okay, if they were on somewhere in this part of the Bronx, they were probably coming from this direction. And so we're going to look for everybody who has a really expensive car, who might, be over here, and they just start searching for it. And then...
Wasn't it the Reverend Bacon gets a list of every Mercedes with, the first two letters that are the approximate letters because he has someone at the DMV. And so they take that list, which is still, thousands of people.
Well, they're somehow able to narrow it down from thousands to hundreds, or more like they're like, well, if we're going to find it at all, if it's not somebody who lives in New York... who lives in Manhattan or lives in this area will never find them. So we'll just assume
it's New York license plates.
Yeah, we'll just assume it's a New York license plate. So we'll just start questioning all the New Yorkers. And now this is like halfway through the book. Two detectives show up at Sherman's swanky apartment. And
his life has been going to shit because he's very stressed that he was possible. Because he sees this case blowing up in the newspapers. He's like, that was me and Maria. Like, I know that was us.
Yeah, he knows.
And so he's been falling apart, and you know he's not trading bonds good, and he's having a real big deal on gold backed by francs or some shit that's falling apart because he's not paying attention because he's so stressed about the almost murder or manslaughter.
And but he's also facing financial pressure of, you know, to fit into this master of the universe world.
He's constantly doing calculations in his head about how much money he needs to make versus how much he has.
Because he's really extended himself. Like, to purchase, you know, because the thing you have to have is this car, and the thing you have to have is this apartment, and then you have to have this amount of staff in your home and all that shit. And he took out a massive, not a mortgage, like a personal loan to buy the apartment. And he owes like $1.7 or $1.8 million. But
he says balloon payment. He owes $1 million balloon payment in like a year.
So those are expensive balloons.
They are. It's a blimp of a payment. Let me tell you. They are. He is in trouble because the interest is going to explode on that, and then it'll be unpayable.
Much like a balloon.
Well, it'll pop. Yeah, and he. Lee doesn't really want to do that, so he ends up having to. He's like, I gotta close this $600 million Krugerrand deal or whatever the fuck it is.
Yeah,
but he starts fucking up things. So, because his commission on that deal will be enough to just square him, and then he can go back to, you know, oh, my $3,000 a month shoe bill or whatever the fuck it is. So yeah, he's got this.
Falls through and. The book has a lot of detail about, you know, what the bonds they're trading are and what they're actually trying to do and the spread. They're trying to get it at this price and they're trying to convince them, which I don't know enough about finance to know if that's true or not, but
it's more or less true.
I bet it's somewhat true. Also, the bond market is actually way bigger than the stock market. But it's not like discussed nearly as much in the news. Like, oh, the stock market hit a high, blah blah blah. Actually, the bond market is gigantic. It is like dwarfs the stock market. So it does actually way more than the stock market does. And people in this, the '80s is when bonds were. I mean, bonds were always a thing, but when like trading bonds on a like Wall Street kind of, you know, finance bro way became a thing,
it started to become cool.
Yeah.
And it started making companies a ass ton of money for doing essentially nothing, which he struggles with the metaphor of telling his daughter what he does. And his wife is like, it's like they take cake and they take it from someone and they give it to somebody else, and then they pick up all the little crumbs that are left over. He's like, that's so not true. But that is kind of true. It's like he's hoping for, you know, 0.04% of a, you know, a margin on all his sales. And it's like, yeah, you are just middlemen. Making money off doing fucking nothing. But he's a master of the universe. And these guys don't
believe
that.
Of money. So two detectives show up at his apartment, and instead of saying, I'm sorry, go talk to my lawyer, or I won't speak to you without a lawyer present, because he's worried that'll make him look guilty. So he's like, oh, yes, I'll talk to you, sure. And then, because he had seen on the news the night before, authorities are looking for a Mercedes with a license plate starting with the letter R or something like that. And his wife goes, don't we own a Mercedes with the license plate with starting with the letter R? He's like, oh, yes. What a funny coincidence. And so the detectives like talk to him, and he just, because he's bad at lying, he just is so nervous and just totally gives away. I mean, he doesn't say specifically it was me, but he was just acts so suspiciously that the detectives are like, yep, we found him.
These detectives did not believe they were going to find the guy at all, and then immediately they're just like, I think this guy actually fucking did it. He is so pathetic.
If he had instead said, I'm sorry, speak to my lawyer, and they would have probably never followed up. They would never have followed up, which means they never would have found him. The detectives also find his garage where he parks his car and asks the garage attendant if Sherman had taken the car out that night. He's like, oh yeah, he did. And he came back very nervous. And it's like, well, there was basically duty all over right the seat.
There's like a pair of lips of a juror. So he really, he shits the bed there. And
then they go to an awkward party, which is a weird scene where he has to go to a party and pretend everything's okay. And his wife is there and his mistress is there. And he hasn't seen her since she fled the country again because of the whole murder thing. Manslaughter thing.
Man's laughter.
And there's a whole bunch of funny things where they talk about a lady, the guy, he's seated, you know, they're doing the old timey rules where you're like, talk to the person on your left and then you talk to the person on your right.
Like
you
there's know, a like seating archaic chart. Times. Yes. There's a seating arrangement and he's seated not next to his wife, but next to his mistress.
And to a real estate lady who he is insulted to be sitting again around someone so low. And she tells a funny story about a guy at the table who has AIDS. It's like, he's got AIDS, look out. And then the guy tells the story of the Mask of the Red Death, and no one gets the incredible metaphor, and they just talk about the AIDS.
I mean, in 1987, okay. AIDS was pretty wild. That's like pretty gallows humor for that crowd, I feel like, in the 80s.
Yeah.
How edgy.
Oh, they were edging.
Well, yeah, we don't have Masters of the Universe anymore. We have Edgelords. So I'm not quite sure what an edgelord is, actually, but I've heard that phrase.
Edgelords are people that say off-color jokes or, you know, like pushing things to the edge. Like, basically, they say racist and, like, shitty shit. They're like, yeah, ooh, I'm edgy. Like, fuck off, man.
Oh, I see. We never do that. Yeah. Okay, good. So... We never get that close. I never get that close.
We're edge barons at best.
Edge barons? That edge viscount.
I don't know if a baron's higher or lower than a lord. Maybe they're all lords. I don't give a fuck. Whatever.
Edge marquee. It's my rap name. But he gets arrested. So there's a lot of book. Just arrest him already. But
he's going to get arrested, but he goes talk to his, you know, old WASP lawyer because he's like, you need a good WASP lawyer, not a Jew lawyer for certain things. But the WASP lawyer is like, I deal with, you know, party fouls and bad manners. You should get a good
and also
a good
financial
Irish
stuff.
Lawyer.
Yeah, financial stuff. Like, and so he's like, no, you need one of those like criminal lawyers.
They're all go, Irish.
Go talk to the Irish guys.
And so he slums it and goes find fucking...
Paddy McShamison.
Paddy McShamison, Killian? Basically, the Irish lawyer.
It's and he, you Killian. Know,
he
something.
Went to Yale.
Oh,
but,
yeah, we
should have
gotten a Killian's Irish Red.
But yeah, he gets a shitty lawyer. No, actually, he's a good lawyer, but like he doesn't talk proper, so Sherman thinks he's shit. But he knows how to do crime laws because he knows how the system works because he's part of the system. And all the cops and the judges are Irish, so they owe each other Irish favors.
That's an Irish favor is a hand job where you don't say goodbye.
No, that's where you use a potato.
Do a real Irish favor on him.
Is that sour cream?
Oh.
Ew. Yes. Eventually he does get arrested.
No charge. This one's au gratin. So then he's like, oh, you're getting arrested. Sorry, whoops.
He's incensed that they would come arrest him at his home, so he goes to the police precinct and said to surrender himself or outside his house or some shit. I don't remember. Doesn't matter.
But at this point, he has to tell his boss. It's like, all right, well, you can't keep working here. So you are on a leave now. He's like, okay, that's going to help.
You fucked up the gold Franks deal.
And everyone's like, God damn it, he's not cool anymore. And they don't want to be his friend.
No. And at this point, he also has to tell his wife about what happened. He's like, I didn't fuck this lady, but like we were just like flirting, and then she hit somebody with a car. It's not my fault.
And the wife doesn't believe him for a second.
No, because he's the world's worst fucking liar.
Yeah, so he gets arrested, and then there's a whole long scene where he like has to go. He has to get arrested and booked in the Bronx with the other Bronx people. And even though he's only there for a little while, because he's like, oh, your bond's going to be, you know, $10,000. So he's like, okay, I'll just take $10,000 out of the bank, and I'll bring it with me. And then after, I can just post bond right away and get, you know, get out of prison. But he still has to be there a couple hours, and there's some, like, for him, this is a very harrowing experience, and he's like, I was never the same. I became a man.
No, we forgot that he gets confirmed that it's him because the other guy that the kid that got hit by the car was with, he gets busted for something else, and he says, I'll talk about that hit and run that you all know about. I was there. And he says, like, oh, you know, I was just fucking around with the kid, and then that this guy did it, and it was a lady, and that's not his wife, ha-ha, but if you let me, you know, cut a deal with me, I'll testify that it was him. And they're like, yeah, sure, that's fine.
Just need to close these cases. We don't care how. And when he's in jail, you'd think he's pretty freaked out. What's his name? Sherman, right? He probably said at least once, oops, I hopped my pants. This is Oops, I Hopped My Pants from Sand City, which is an IPA, 6.5% alcohol. We should say this beer and all of our beers are brought to us by our supporters over at Patreon. I think a patron suggested this book, and that's why we read it, because there's no good goddamn reason we'd read a 37-year-old book.
Yeah, why that? I don't know why we read this. So hopefully
this was a patron request.
You are welcome, fine people.
I don't know. This has been on the list for a very long time.
I think it was a patron.
Oh.
Yeah, I don't know.
So it's perhaps someone who gave us money and then stopped.
Yeah. Uh-oh. Come back. We did it at
Oops.
Last.
We only took 2 years to get to it.
This book took 2 years to read. Jesus Christ. If you want to support the podcast, you could first off, you could help us out, and you should all do it right now. Leave us a 5-star review wherever you're listening.
They requested this book in June of 2022.
Not 2 years.
It hasn't come out yet, so that might be 2 years.
And
well, we are men of our words. We get it done.
I'm pretty sure we always say something non-committal, like we'll put it on the list.
Oh yeah, that is what we say. The list is just, you know, increasingly long.
But if you want to support the podcast, leave us a good review. That really helps, because it makes me less sad. And if we spend less time crying in the shower, we could read more books. And you could also help out by going to patreon.com/drunkguysbookclub and becoming a supporter for as little as $1 a month, you cheap fuckers. You can support the podcast, and we won't make you wait 2 years.
And buy us a beer.
But yeah, buy
us. That's all we're asking.
Yeah.
You know, this isn't our day job, but you know what? Buy us a beer.
It's not our day job, but you could help with our day drinking. Or just tell someone to check out the podcast and then, you know, make sure they do. Threaten them. Whatever it takes.
When you're in a lockup in the Bronx, make sure to mention the Drunk Guys Book Club podcast. Yeah.
That's true. That's very much our demo.
Well, back to this book.
Anyway, more news stories come out, and especially because now that the police have arrested a suspect, everyone was like, he did it. String him up. They're like protests outside his apartment building, and the other people, so all the other people in the building were also extremely rich people. They're like really annoyed. The people are like, you know, please leave. And he's like, no, this is my home, damn it. But yet the case gets, you know, the case heats up because people find out that there was a woman there, because the other guy who, like, you know, tells the story, who the other guy, the who almost got run over, tells a story about what happened, and then they have all a bunch of stuff, and then like the newspaper stories keep coming out, and there are protests.
Fallow is running around New York writing these stories, and he's like the talk of the town, you know, because he's uncovered this big story. He's like a new hot journalist, and in one of his various sessions of drinking about town, someone says, like, because he's in with like the hip crowd, and it's like, I know who the woman was. And he tells him who it was, and he knows it's Maria. And so he goes to meet her husband, who is a, you know, an old guy. And he goes to have dinner with him at a restaurant.
So he is an older,
very high-end place.
At a very high-end place. He's an older Jewish guy. But yet he made his money providing flights to Mecca.
Yeah.
That's how he made, like, it was a completely a secret that this Jewish, that the airline was actually owned by a Jew. But his thing was providing flights to Mecca for the Hajj, which is one of those satire things in the book. But then he dies. He literally has a heart attack and dies at the restaurant.
Yeah. And they can't get him through the revolving door. They can't get the stretcher through the revolving door with him on it. So they have to hoist him out the bathroom window. And it's, you know, comical. And then Fallow can't pay for the bill because he's not rich and they're at a very fancy restaurant, so he skips out on it. And then they have, you know, a million things happen.
There's a funeral and
Maria comes back for the funeral because that's the only place that they know she's going to be at. And so fucking, what's his name?
The reporter is there, but also Sherman. Yeah.
He's trying to find her.
Goes there to find her, but he also wears a wire and he's trying to get her to admit on tape that she was the one who was driving, because that's his only hope, that she was the driver. So even though it was his car, but she was driving, so she killed the kid, or he's still in a coma, but
he's clearly dying.
Yeah,
very slowly.
For the whole book it's like, no, he's gonna die, he'll never get out of this. She manages not to, but yet, because now it's out there that she might be involved, the police come see her, and she has two very expensive lawyers. And then she goes and testifies to the grand jury, but she doesn't say that she was driving. She says it's Sherman's car, and Sherman did it. But then there's a lot of convoluted who made the recording stuff.
Basically, what happened is, earlier in the book, while he's in there with Maria, and they're talking about what happened, a quote-unquote giant Jew comes in, and he's trying to, like, get a hold of the lady she's subletting from, because apparently it's a scheme that people have these rent-controlled apartments, and they sublet them for more money, and the landlords don't take kindly to that, you know. So in the end, it turns out that the landlord had put recording devices in the intercoms in the apartments to get around to find out who was subletting from them and taking their rent money. And so it turns out that they have this tape of her talking about how she did it. And so they're going to pretend that Sherman recorded that conversation with her, even though he never actually did, because they can't use that conversation, that tape, because it's illegal. But he's like, oh, actually, I did do this recording. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. And so...
So the final scene of the book is Sherman is brought back to court because the grand jury has indicted him for killing the kid, or for manslaughter. Not for manslaughter yet, but reckless, whatever. And he goes in, but then the Sherman and the lawyer say, "Hey, we have Your Honor, we have this tape. Like, he was indicted, but we have evidence that we want to show." And so they get they go into the judge's chambers and they like play the first tape, which where Maria says something, and then they play the second tape. But the second tape is the one that's illegal, but he pretends that he actually recorded that one as well, because he did actually go to see Maria wearing a wire more than once. This just wasn't one of the times. And then the judge throws out the indictment, and there's like all of this, all the people in the courtroom are like so angry, and
there's a fucking riot.
Yeah, there's a riot. There's like a fight scene where they're just trying to get out of the courthouse. And Sherman is like, yeah, and I punched a guy, and I'm a man now, because that's like his journey.
Meanwhile, at the beginning of the book, he was talking about how he was so brave for fighting off that guy with a tire. He says he almost, you know, how he defended her from the jungle, which, you know, has racial overtones. But, you know, nothing explicit as all the comments about every other thing about race in the rest of the book.
Yeah, but referring to the South Bronx as the jungle has racial over, under, and inner tones.
Regular tones.
It's like a sine wave of sound, tone.
It covers all tones.
It's just one tone. So this case is dismissed, but there's chaos. But wait, there's still more book.
And there's an epilogue.
You're like, oh, that could be an end. That could have ended there. And Tom was like, no.
Yeah.
Hold my white linen suit.
My guess is that is how it ended when it was originally in the magazine published as in serial form. It just ended right there. Or more like then Rolling Stone was like, that's enough. you
we sat through this for 6 years, man. We're done.
Yeah. And then but in the book version, there was an epilogue where it's like, yeah, and a year later, Sherman is brought in because the kid finally died. So now he's being charged with manslaughter. And now he's like, I don't care about anything anymore. I'm just a defendant now.
His life is
not
ruined.
Poor, but he's not rich.
Well, like his wife and kid, his kid was like the one thing he liked. The wife took that. He's lost that. You know, he was a shitty dad.
Because he spent all his money on lawyers and on bodyguards. And so he had to give up his place. And also, Kramer got in trouble and got taken off the case because he tried to get the hot juror the rent-controlled apartment he kept hearing about. He was obsessed with his rent-controlled apartment. So he tried to put his mistress in there as a fuck pad. But that didn't work.
And it ends. Oh, and Sherman has been sued by the Lamb family and lost for civil penalties. So he owes them $10 million or something like that.
Which is just like the OJ case, but that hadn't happened yet.
Yeah.
Life imitating art.
Oh, and also he didn't cut off his kid's head in a waiter. Kill a waiter.
No, he didn't.
And so it ends. He's waiting to get his next criminal trial. And he is clearly no longer the master of the universe.
Never was.
Well, that's the hard lesson he had to learn, like a Greek myth. He had to learn he was not master of the universe.
Whoa, don't get us started on the Greeks.
what would they have said, Jimmy? What would a Greek character have said in this book?
You can't go into Bronx because there's got no baklava there. But you got good hair product there for shoulders.
No good diners there.
No.
12 closed, not 24 hour. No lobster
goat
tank.
No meat.
No breakfast, 4 a.m.
Yeah. Speaking of 4 a.m. breakfast, that's about how long this book feels.
It was four books. It was like a Lord of the Rings set in 1987 New York.
Yeah. There and back again. The Bronx. The Bronx is Mordor. You cast the tire into the fire.
The Mercedes, they takes it from us.
It's my precious.
Stupid fat bonds traders.
What'd you guys think?
Yeah.
What'd you think?
It's too fucking long.
Yeah. It was a very long book. So in my head, I'm comparing it to American Psycho.
Oh,
because that was... They're very similar because this is like kind of satire of the 80s New York, and American Psycho was very much, very satire of 80s New York.
So I guess this was... When was American Psycho written?
I want to say 89.
So it was written also in the 80s. Okay.
Let's see, American Psycho...
But it wasn't like...
Oh, published in 91. But
still in the window. It's close enough, yeah. Close enough. It is still kind of about the same thing. And I wanted more satire, but less plot.
It felt like not even a satire to me most of the time.
I mean, it was a little bit... it was a bit absurd, just all the stuff going on.
Yeah, it was a little zany at times. But like... You get like a satire.
Like it was like, only a tiny bit satire, and I actually wanted more.
It would have been better if there was more. Because this felt like none of the characters felt like that unrealistic. Maybe we've just been jaded by 40 years of what Wall Street people are like, or I don't know. A lot of the racial stereotypes are kind of odd. Like cops are all Irish or Italian, and the Jew lawyers and stuff. Like, okay, sure. But like
it's just dated.
Beyond that, like it didn't feel particularly satirical. These were pretty tame characters. Like, yeah, he's a rich dickhead who thinks he's important because he trades bonds, and like the poor ADA. Like, it didn't really feel like a satire at all. It just felt like, yeah, everyone sucked. It's not really satire. Like, it's just an objective picture of how shitty everybody is.
But does satire have to be exaggerated to that level? I mean, because he's just kind of like the whole, everything works out in a kind of ridiculous way in the book. Right? Like,
does it work out? It doesn't really even end.
That's not the right word. It's like everything transpires in a ridiculous way. Like, because the Bond guy is so arrogant and so much of a fucking wimp, like his actions are circumscribed or whatever. And then because of the wimpy mayor, and because of the race issue in New York City, and because of like all these things are brought into hyper focus where like they typically wouldn't be in a plot. Like, I think that's the satirical part, like that every single thing has to happen, you know, like the normal
perfect storm.
Yeah, exactly. Perfect storm. That's the satirical part.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. I guess when I hear satire, I think usually like...
It's usually over the top, though.
Sarcastic or over the top sometimes, but even when it's not over the top, it is like wink, wink, nudge, nudge, like...
Well, because you like, want people to notice like that. You want people to know,
yeah.
Get it? See?
Like this was felt. It felt pretty, not straightforward, but almost straightforward.
Maybe that's because 40 years later... we are maybe used to it.
Think this way of how things were then.
Things are crazier now.
Or 40 years later, this is the only thing people remember about 80s New York.
Mm.
So it's like, isn't this real life? Not satire?
It's a good point.
Also life imitating art?
Maybe. Eventually.
Eventually.
But yeah, that's a good point, Nate.
I also thought there wasn't really an ending. I mean, it technically ends.
No, there definitely wasn't an ending.
And thank God it ends, but because there's too much of it. But it's not. It doesn't really come to a conclusion. It doesn't really resolve anything, especially, I mean, there is the tacked on like epilogue where Sherman is just like going back on trial again, but it kind of doesn't, nothing really gets wrapped up.
But maybe that's kind of, again, like the satirical part about New York is that, you know, this guy's story doesn't end, but like this, like no one cares about it anymore. Like no one cares that the kid actually died. Like they've moved on to the next issue. They've moved on to the next thing to protest. They've moved on to the next cause célèbre or whatever. And that's what a very New York kind of thing, right? Like people are distracted, or a very big city kind of thing. People are distracted by the issue and then it moves on. And then whether it's resolved or not, a new thing comes along and you're like, ooh. Novelty.
I felt like it was a novel written like a news story because like, okay, so Tom Wolfe, that's his name, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Tom Wolfe, he's really more of a journalist than a novelist. Like this was his first novel, but he wrote it like an ongoing news story, but ongoing news stories don't have a neat ending the way a novel would. It doesn't have like a, where all the loose ends get wrapped up and there's like, you know, the characters learned something or they grow. This is really just kind of like stuff kept happening. And I'm sure this is part of the, like, he wrote it, you know, he wrote it in pieces the way the, like Charles Dickens would write stuff and publish it, you know, a week at a time or a month at a time, you know, publish like sections of it. He probably didn't know what was going to happen. And I think I read in the Wikipedia article that he had this like concept for a book, and the editor of Rolling Stone was like, yeah, we'll publish it in pieces. But that was like, but Tom Wolfe needed that as like a motivation to actually work on it. But because he's not a novelist, he didn't have some big ending in mind. And so finally he's like, oh, okay. And then he gets to like this final like court scene where Sherman like is like where he gets the indictment dropped. And he's like, okay, I guess that's the end. Boom. But it's not like a good ending. It just sort of like stops.
He could have taken in about 50% of the middle and used that energy on the ending instead, because it really just felt like filler. Like it, I get that some of it was like, you know, satire of rich people's lives and like, you know, cop life and stuff like that, but it didn't move the plot at all for I would say an easy half of this book could have been cut out and nothing would have been lost.
I think it was just, look at this cool character. Look at this person. Don't you know somebody like this? I feel like that's what a lot of it was.
Most, I'd say 90% of it was these three characters in other places where they have like a one-off meeting with somebody else where it's like, so what?
Did you have never met a guy like that at the bagel shop? Like that's, I think that's what a lot of it was. Just like paint a picture. This is the praise of the book is like, this really captures New York. And I think that's what they're referring to. These little throwaway scenes.
It's full of a lot of bullshit.
It is a lot of bullshit.
I mean, yeah, like captures New York. It's full of a lot of bullshit.
Much like this podcast. So, who should read the book?
I don't know who should read this.
No one.
It's not really part of the zeitgeist anymore.
No.
They made a shitty movie out of it that was universally hated.
I have never seen the movie. I know it existed. I knew it existed before.
I haven't seen it either.
But I think...
few people saw it.
But it had Tom Hanks when he was a big deal, so it must have really sucked.
They said the main criticism of it is like they tried to make him more likable, which is not the point of the book.
But that was the point. That's the point of Tom Hanks, is that he's likable.
Yeah, he's the most likable man. And they also added like another character, like Morgan Freeman playing a judge who like judges all these people for fucking up. But like, no, just no. Though it was probably a more appropriate length.
I saw this thing on YouTube about how the movie of Bonfire of the Vanities has the most expensive shot in cinema history, or at least it was up to that time. They paid a Concorde because Concordes fly New York to London, London, New York, to take off in London, empty, fly all the way to New York, and land at JFK at exactly the right time so it would be backlit by the setting sun. So they literally hired out an entire Concorde just so it would land at JFK at the right time, just to get one shot. And it was like, how much is that? It's like, several $100,000 for just this little filler clip. That's a filler shot that's like 2 seconds long.
That sounds like vanity. And the sun is a big bonfire.
Yes. Yeah, we knew.
Yeah, I don't know who the fuck should read this book. Like, no, it was fine. No. It's not worth the length.
That's what she said.
The story is fine. It's unsurprising. I think it's kind of dated. Satire of the 80s has been done better other places and more satirically.
I think more extreme. Like, the 80s is always portrayed as this, like, really over-the-top period, which it was certainly in some ways, but... That's, as Nate said earlier, I think that's a really good observation. Like, that's all we know about the 80s if we weren't there for it. You know, yeah. So that doesn't mean very
without
accurate.
Without the satire, though. This is just a kind of boring, run-of-the-mill story where everyone's an asshole.
It's like 58% of literature.
Yeah.
It's a boring story where everyone's an asshole. Yeah, I don't think anyone needs to read it now. Maybe it would make sense to read it in 87 because you'd be like, aha, that's us. But
maybe
now,
88 also.
Yeah, fine. But certainly after the movie came out, never again. And then it should have been.
Yeah.
It's a product. Made a bonfire of it.
It's big enough to make a fucking bonfire out of.
It's like, that sounds like the name of a Chuck Norris movie. A Bonfire of One. It's like in a movie called A Force of One.
This book is the Sum 42 album. Mostly filler, no killer. Except he's a killer at the end, I guess. Or she is. He's still on trial for, he wasn't driving, so I don't know how that works. Whatever.
But she testified. I think there should be a remake today where he's a marine biologist, and it's Bonfire of the Manatees.
That was actually the working title for... what the fuck was that Al Gore movie? An Inconvenient Truth.
Inconvenient Truth, : Bonfire of the Manatees. So I guess thanks for recommending this book. I hope we may.
That guy who recommended it is dead by now. I don't know.
I think it was the kid that got hit by the car. tell us what you thought.
Send us an email to drunkguysbookclub@gmail.com.
Follow us on Twitter @drunkguysbc.
or go to Facebook and Instagram at Drunk Guys Book Club.
And go to leave us a review and go to Patreon and leave us your money. Thanks.
And find us on Goodreads, where reading rainbow.
And check out the Hopped Up Network, a network of independent beer podcasters. And thanks for listening.